the next speaker, because my presentation somehow touches on the very same issues, but from a slightly different angle. I'm an anthropologist, and I've been working on the development of the Tibetan medicine industry in Tibet over the last 2 years. And so it was originally planned that I would talk more about like these general issues of GMP and like of government regulations, which is in itself maybe an attempt to cultivate the wild industry. But finally, I decided that it might make more sense to concentrate on one specific aspect, which is exactly this aspect of like supply chains and the question of especially like the cross-border trade of Tibetan medicinal plants. So in some respects, my story I'm going to tell has metaphorical value, because it's the Chinese government has gone a long way to try to provide regulations and to try to do the groundwork that like high quality herbs could be used in the industry. And the thing is that these policies not always have the intended effect or the intended. So me as an anthropologist, I'm going to look at it from this perspective. So nevertheless, just to start, give me a minute to outline what happened to the industry of Tibetan medicine over the last 10 years. Presently, there are around maybe 24 factories, like major GMP factories of Tibetan medicine on the Tibetan plateau in China. It always depends on how you count them. If you count the small ones also, then it's much more. If you count the ones that produce just one or two Tibetan medicines, but otherwise Chinese medicines, then it's also more. That's about the factories I know of. All of these factories have been rebuilt between 2002 and 2004, which was a requirement because they had to comply with these GMP, good manufacturing practices, rules, which China actually had to introduce when they became a member of the WTO in like 2001. The thing is that the industry still is largely based on wildcrafted herbs. That's we have heard before. There is almost no cultivation. Only for a very few of the herbs there is cultivation. So Tibetan medicine does not really fit into the category of local knowledge or of a local medical system based on locally available herbs. It has always been its materia medica has always been based to a considerable part on imported herbs. It's very difficult to put a figure on this, but what I did is in one herb store I came to know quite closely and who is working exclusively with a Tibetan medicine industry, with one factory actually, I did an inventory. And just to get a ballpark figure, about 80% of the species they traded were actually sourced within the territory of the People's Republic of China, and 20% were imported. But if you look at the volumes, then it's almost 50-50. So almost 50% of the volume this shop sold came actually from India and Nepal. And about 50% came from the People's Republic of China. So that is mainly due to the fact that most Tibetan formulas contain three ingredients. They're called Aru, Baru, and Kyuru, which is the Terminalia, Cebula, Bellerica, and the Emlica officinalis. They form a basis for many of the Tibetan formulas. So, as I've said, like China has done a considerable effort to regulate the herbal industry, not only through GMP, but also through this tremendous work of making a Chinese pharmacopoeia. Many appendices, they also have a draft version of good agricultural practices, which is not binding yet. There is nothing on collection, though. Like, the collection part has been excluded totally. And there was one thing that actually had a lot of impact, which was the drug administration law that came into effect in 2001. It was complemented by several provisions afterwards. But what I want to say is that drugs in the drug administration law are actually defined very broadly. They include everything from herbs to antibiotics to vaccines. Everything is drugs. But there are many exemptions and special rules for so-called Chinese crude drugs. So the Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine had enough lobby to look for their exemptions and to get a good deal actually in this legislations. But all these exemptions, they only apply to crude drugs sourced in China, and they do not apply to imported herbs. So now we have the situation that actually for the important herbs, from India and Nepal for half of the volume, you have legislation that is doesn't make a difference between a herb and an antibiotic. All these provisions, when I started my research in 2007, none of this had any impact, actually. When I was talking to herb traders, they didn't even know about these regulations and they didn't care. It was just not enforced. But then in 2006, there were like provisions for the import of crude drugs. They were basically reiterating the same kind of line laid out in the Drug Administration Law of 2001. Basically saying that you need a license to import each and every species of herb. And the import has to go via an authorized port. So you cannot just go anywhere over the border, you have to go through a specific border. Yeah. And then after you import them, it's compulsory to have all your drugs, your herbs tested in a government laboratory. Also, these provisions at first didn't have much impact, actually. But then things, like in summer 2008, actually after all the trouble in Tibet on March 14th, 2008, and its whole aftermath, things started to change radically. So what I'm going to talk about are these very recent changes in what happened in this transnational cross-border plant trade. Let me just have a very quick look at how this licensing system actually works. Now you need a license to import to her. So you have a trader. The trader, he approaches the State Food and Drug Administration in Beijing. So every trader has to get a license directly from Beijing. He gets a license for a specific herb. This license includes the botanical name, the Chinese name, but not the Tibetan name, the enterprise in the People's Republic, usually a factory, or if it's a big herb trader, the herb trader, and a trading partner in Nepal, a fixed trading partner in Nepal. This entitles you to unlimited imports over 2 years. And for each of these, for each one, for each herb, you have to pay around 2,000, 2,200 yuan. So it's about $300 the license costs for each herb. But that's not enough. Once you have that, you still cannot import herbs. What you then have to do is you have to approach the local authorities, and the local authorities will issue an import permit. And the import permit contains like the volume of planned imports. So I'm going to import like 5 tons of aru, and it has a limited validity. So you have to do the import within 1 month. So, in December 2008, I had the opportunity to join a herb trader on a business trip to Nepal. And I will call him Nima. And the following is an account of my journey with Nima, and which I hope will provide an insight into the strategies and ways to deal with this new import regime. For Nima, it was his very first journey to Nepal, because before that, his father was doing that business, but the father considered himself to be too old for this strenuous travels. And Nima was quite young, and he really felt the burden of responsibility on his shoulders. So the plan was to buy about 20 tons of herbs on this occasion, 24 species of herbs. Nima showed me his list of these 2 dozen herbs, but when I asked him for the licenses, he only had 2. So he told me, well, last time we had 5 licenses, but that was actually too much. It was just a waste of money. So the current situation, as he judged it to be, was that without a license and import permit, cross-border trade would have simply been impossible. But a license to cover each and every herb was at that point not necessary. The licensing system was very difficult because tying a trader to a trade partner in Nepal is somehow utopian. How do you know that this trade partner in Nepal would have the herbs on stock? How do you know that the quality would be good and consistent? What if he started abusing the terms of this agreement? What if, for example, he went out of business? So it was safer to kind of only do it with as little as necessary. The other thing is that they have very mixed experiences with drug testing on import. In summer 2008, the first time they did an import under this new regime, 2 of their herbs were confiscated, and they lost almost 50,000 yuan at the border. One of the herbs that didn't pass the test was nutmeg, just simple nutmeg. And from another factory in Tibet, I learned that they had the same problem with nutmeg, with zati. I was told that the variety, I couldn't confirm that, but I was told that the variety they import from Nepal is actually the better one. But the like the standardized test they were applying was based on the Chinese variety. And on the license, there is only the Latin botanical names and the Chinese names. So in the end, I know of two instances where this nutmeg couldn't be imported because of this potential taxonomical problems. So we have a lack of trust and knowledge in this drug testing system. My herb trader friend also said, look, they just put everything in their machine. You bring them a bag of Aru, and they say, what is this? You say Aru. They ask you, how do you spell that? They have no idea about any Tibetan medicine. So he said, it's like a game machine. You put some money in, and either you win or lose. So under these circumstances, it was much safer to avoid the official procedure as much as possible. And in order to do that, the existence of a specific license was a precondition. Its ambit, however, was not necessarily relevant. A license was more like an entry ticket. And it enabled the officials involved to present something to their superiors. And it kind of produced a coherent document truth. And once this document truth were there, regardless of the obvious reality of a truck passing with 20 herbs or 40 herbs, it was possible to still reap the benefits of turning a blind eye on the specificities of a specific import. Yeah, this means like there was this trade, a little money against the necessary leeway to stay in business, to find ways around the quirks of this utopian licensing system. So after we got all the permits and visas and stuff, we headed for the border, Nima and me, the border between Nepal and Tibet, which is called the Friendship Highway, and there is a little bridge which separates the two worlds, which is called the Friendship Bridge. And I've always been fascinated by this border crossing. It really marks off two different worlds. Coming from China, the other side of the bridge is the immediate and sudden beginning of the Indian subcontinent somehow. The smells, the looks, the aesthetics, the behavior, etiquette, humor, truck drivers, ways of doing business, ways of dealing with authorities, all is very, very different on the other side. So in my view, this contrast is a crucial one for the understanding of the subtle quirks of the cross-border trade. Doing business in China and doing business in Nepal require a different set of skills, different strategies, and it's sometimes difficult to create trustful relationships across this border. It's very interesting. The Tibetans in Tibet, they always complain about Chinese business culture and all the Chinese are always looking for their advantage. It's very difficult to deal with them, very difficult to trust them. They cheat you and so on. If you go to the Nepali traders, they tell you exactly the same thing about their Tibetan customers, always looking for their own advantage, never really trustful. And if you go to India, then again, and you ask like the Marwari or the Muslim traders in India, they tell you, oh, you know, the Nepali traders, they are the worst. You cannot trust them. It's just impossible to do serious business with them. So in any situation like cross-border trade inherently makes one party an outsider and one party an insider. And it's kind of difficult sometimes to bridge this gap. So what we did is Nima's father had like one Marwari trader in Kathmandu he had done business before. And we went to his shop first. And the shop is located in a tiny alleyway between, for those who know Kathmandu, between New Road and Durbar Square. It's literally about that wide. And there are many, many herb shops. But they all kind of serve as contact points to the real mansions and storerooms where the herb traders are. So we came to this Marwari family, and it was spacious mansions, and we were received by two brothers of the family. And it was really interesting. At the outset, the brothers, they were very skeptical against Nima because they hadn't seen him before. So it took a while until like they really believed him that he was the son of his father and that he was now in charge of this herbs trade and stuff. But in time, like the atmosphere warmed up and they started discussing about like the availability and qualities and prices of all the 24 herbs he wanted to buy. What I will do now is I will focus on only three of these 24 herbs. The first one is Baru. Baru is the Terminalia biliarica. As mentioned before, like Aru, Baru and Kyuru are three basic ingredients imported in large quantities to Tibet. And Nima's aim was to buy 5 tons of Baru. The thing was, Baru is harvested in autumn, but it was already early December. The thing was that we couldn't find Baru in large quantities. It still hadn't arrived in Kathmandu. It was kind of late this year. Like many herb traders told us, oh yeah, the new harvest was just about to come in. We just would have to wait for two weeks or so. because the baru we were shown was like last year's baru and was of quite bad quality. It was very obvious, actually. But this put Nima in such a difficult position because the import permit he had, he was only valid for 1 month. He didn't have time to wait, and he was kind of in this, shall I wait for 2 weeks? But what if the import doesn't materialize then? What will I do? Yeah, and then I have to make my way back to Shigatse, and what if the permit expires, and so on and so on. So what he did in the end is he considered it too risky to wait. So he bought it. So actually, in this case, this Chinese licensing system has, and the import permits that actually aim at ensuring steady supplies and stable qualities have had exactly the contrary effect. He bought bad aru, and this aru has by now been sold to Tibetan medicine factories, and we have consumed it. So the second example is Jetik, the Chiraita we were talking about the other day. Yeah. So most of this Jetik actually comes now from Nepal, and most of it is, a considerable part of it is cultivated, like in eastern Nepal. Okay, let me be shorter then. So we were looking for Jetik, and we found this one trader who had like 2 tons of Jetik on store. Now you have to know that Jetik is all these long plants you use, like all of it, but they're quite light, but quite difficult to transport because they're quite bulky. So usually they strap them into bales, they compress them in order to transport them to Tibet. But Nima was very nervous about this whole packaging issue. He wanted to be present because he said, you never know what they put inside these bales. Yeah, it's grass and dirt and whatever. So we went quite early to this plant trader just to supervise the packaging, yeah? But it had already started. And what Nima saw, it kind of depressed him. Of course, it was like there were lots of other things in it. And the thing was, the whole Jetik they were packing was still slightly wet. And parts of it had already turned black. So he started complaining to this Mawari plant trader and said, what can we do? This is not good quality Jetik. And well, the Mawari plant trader, I call him Agarwal for ease. He said, well, that's the way I was able to buy it this year. Because this year we had a long monsoon, and this year Dasain, this like the Hindu festival celebrated all over Nepal, was very early. Because Dasain was early, people had to have raised some money for Dasain. So they harvested the Jatik 2 weeks earlier than usual, so it was wetter when he came here. But it continued raining, so we couldn't really dry it. So in this case, it was like the combination of an early Dasain and a long monsoon, together with Niemann's short time frame, that made the Jatik he had to purchase finally actually not the best quality one. If that's also kind of a thing about wholesale trade. I mean, if he had bought 200 kgs of Jatik, he would have had many options in Kathmandu, and also very much better quality. But 2 tons of Jatik was just impossible to find, only this one. So now we have 3 minutes left. So let's skip the last one. That would be about Sergimeto. Let's just go and see what happened on the way back, when Nima went back with his plants. Actually, on the border, all of his plants were confiscated. The whole truck, all the 24 species he bought. The deputy customs officer at Jam, he's a Tibetan, he told him that now there was no way to import herbs without like licenses for each and every herb. He went to the chief customs officer, who is at the moment a Chinese, and explained that it was first time and he didn't know and so on and so on. And actually this Chinese guy was quite understanding, and he almost kind of granted him an exception and said, okay, go. But then this other Tibetan guy came in and he was very angry that Nima had tried to bypass him and so on. And in the end, the whole stuff was confiscated. He was granted 3 months to get the permits. In order, while the herbs were stored in Drum, he had to pay for storage. He was granted 3 months to get all the necessary permits. No way to get permits in 3 months. In 6 months, he managed to get one permit, the one for Chiraita, for Jatik. So he went back with this permit to the border. And for 2 weeks, he kind of kept negotiating, going to the office, giving cigarettes. And after 2 weeks, he had them. After 2 weeks, they said, okay, go. So he took all his herbs and he was able to transport them to back to Lhasa. Did he pay any bribes? No. Astonishingly enough, not. Mm. Only cigarettes and one hotel bill. Everybody involved was completely aware that this was not a possible situation. Yeah. So they kind of, as soon as control was no longer that strict, they kind of found a way for him. Mm. Next time he came, no problem. He knew everybody. They only opened one bag in the back of his truck and said, okay, go. So what has happened? I mean, we have this story, we have these new policies, and they are actually, yeah, they meant to improve the quality and safety of the imported herbs. But they hadn't the contrary effect. So there are like different ways of interpretation you could try to apply. One would be to say, okay, it's just a lack of enforcement, yeah? It's bad implementation. It's not good governance. It's local corruption. It's whatever. That's very often like the global health view people adopt. And it's very often also, if something goes wrong, it's also like the Chinese party state view of how things go. So we have to just implement better. That's one way of explaining it. And another way could also be that you could also say that it's kind of on purpose, yeah? As you make so many impossible-to-meet rules that everybody is always in violation of this or that rule, so everybody's always kept in line if you have a case against anybody at any time. So, and especially in Tibet, where the security question very often tops all the other questions, this might be one of the reasons. I don't know, but let's just for a second, for my last 1 minute, assume that, like, the Chinese policies are actually really well intended and actually really want to provide a better way for Tibetan medicine to develop or whatever. So what could be a third kind of way to interpret these things? And I think, like, there is a very simple way of put it. It comes down to bargaining power. Like, Tibetan medicine is so tiny and so small compared to, like, traditional Chinese medicine that they simply don't, like, until now, Tibetan medicine, and it's not only herbs trade, you can see that in many different areas of, like, factory development. It was very difficult to deal with, like, the State Food and Drug Administration and, like, the major authorities, health department in China for Tibetan medicine, because they were always, like, subsumed under Chinese medicine, but very difficult to find a bargaining position to say, look, we need these rules. So I'm actually tending towards the third kind of explanation, that is like the major issue of all these policy things. Thank you very much. Pardon? But Sergi?
I thought you would say something on Sergi Mehto.
On Sergi Mehto? Okay, just a very, very, very short thing on Sergi Mehto. The thing is, like, Sergi Mehto is actually not a rare plant, yeah? It's growing everywhere. There are, like, in Tibetan medicine, there are, like, as far as I know, but there are people much more knowledgeable about this here, but as far as I know, there are, like, two or three kinds of it, yeah? There are, like, the white, bigger, whiter seeds, and there are, like, the smaller black ones, and there are the bigger black ones, which are sometimes called serpu in some regions. But the thing is with serme is it's everywhere, actually, in middle altitudes. But still, in, like, the plant is a climber, yeah? It grows, like, from eastern Tibet to Nepal to many different regions. The thing was that already in 2008 there was a pronounced shortage of serme in Tibet. Everybody coming to Kathmandu tried to get some serme from the traders in Kathmandu, and they completely ran out of serme. So the price for serme rocketed from about 80 to 160 yuan per kg in Lhasa in summer 2008. And until now, I've just checked again with traders in Kathmandu. Until now, there is no serme available on the good quality little black seeds. No serme available on the market in Kathmandu, as far as I've seen. So this example is for me like a third one that shows that sometimes even for the non-endangered species, which could be easily cultivated, there might be like a very pronounced shortage for a certain time. Of course, one could say maybe it's a question of demand and supply, and maybe somebody's going to cultivate it and so, but this has been like for 2 years now, and it's still kind of the same, yeah. So that was my little Sirmi story. Prima Gesellin.
If I have not misunderstood, Cheleta is
Dikta. Well, the Tibetans, there is Peti Jatith. Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, they call them, the Nepali traders in my shops, they call this Charaita. And the Tibetans, they call the Petik, they call Jatik now. So the Jatik. I've been in Amdo too long, so it's Jatik. Jatik, of course, yeah. Gyagatikta, yeah. Okay, sorry.
Maybe one or two, I think it was the better message. One or two more questions while we switch computers.
Choose one more person.
Okay. Any more questions?
I just wanted to ask you, I find that interesting about regulations. And I think when you work on Tibet, you should have to put China into the bigger world. Because China is, of course, reacting
exactly
to regulations, yeah, from the WHO, from
exactly
public health, and all these regulations.
I have two things about that. Oh, one is that I just
continue.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
I was just in fieldwork where Chinese were talking about this problem, and then they were saying, well, the West, they always have these FAR, they always have these rules, but we in China, we talk about Guanxing. And you know, this is all the Guanxing literature you have. And I wonder when